Hello all, welcome to the Book Spider Podcast, a book of the week style program that discusses literature of all kinds, usually novels, but also plays, poetry, short stories, and creative nonfiction. We also devote an occasional episode to theoretical topics, including morality and truth in literature, as well as our relationship to artists themselves. This episode, we're trying to do something special. We're discussing I'm Here, Alaska Stories by David Nicky Krause, who is also a former professor of all three hosts, Patrick Barney, which is me, Chris Malmberg, and Hans Berger. The special part is that through my charm and good looks, I've gotten David to join us. Tell our listeners about yourself, David.
Hi, it's nice to be here. I'm David Nicky Krause. I'm predominantly a short story writer, also a teacher, and I'm author of my latest collection, I'm Here, Alaska Stories. It's a collection of almost half a dozen stories about interior Alaska.
So let's get to it. First question. I'm curious about what makes these stories Alaskan. Obviously, a good majority of them take place in Alaska, and others feature characters who have lived in Alaska. But is this the extent of what makes them Alaskan, contents only? Or does something in their structure make them Alaskan as well?
Yeah, that's a great starting question. For a long time, when I was actually living in Alaska, I didn't write about Alaska. I felt that I had kind of complex feelings about writing about Alaska. I think other people were doing it in ways that I admired, but I felt like I didn't know my way into writing about Alaska. I kind of was doing self-examination after I left Alaska, because I missed Alaska a lot and wanted to write about it, but again, still couldn't find my way into it. I had written a couple stories about Alaska, but that was about it. And, so I was thinking about what I was afraid of in writing about Alaska. And this is a long answer, but we'll get to it'll land on your question pretty directly by the end. So I think one of my worries about it was mythologizing Alaska, because, you know, even though I had lived there for, you know, in total maybe 9 years, it still felt like I was a bit of a tourist, obviously. I was afraid of misrepresenting and mythologizing a place that I loved. I think I came to the conclusion that that's what I should write about. So these stories are about Alaska, not just because they all are in some ways just about Alaska in a more general kind of way of geography, but also because they're about this idea of mythologizing a place. So that felt like suddenly then I was writing, you know, I just found a thematic through line, and I was able to write all sorts of things about this place that I loved in a way that felt unique to me. It also aligned with just everything else that I had written up to that point in my career, because I'm very interested in just writing about identity and falsification of identity and what, you know, I have lots of liars in my stories and that kind of thing. Lots of people who lie to themselves as well as to others. So it just felt like all these kind of ideas about fantasy and self-mythologizing just tied in with these stories. So even the stories that aren't taking place directly in Alaska, which most of them actually do, but the couple that don't have to do with outsiders who are mythologizing Alaska. So like there's a story in the middle of the book, The Alaska Girl, which is kind of about, in an indirect way, about the 2008 housing crisis, but it's really someone taking all their angst about that and putting it into this romance about a girl who may or may not be in Alaska and what that means to this gentleman who's never been to Alaska and is going through this horrible state in his life. So those stories felt even necessary to kind of get somewhat of an outsider's, someone who's way outside, point of view, and how that they kind of twist information about the place into a shape that makes some kind of sense for them, because they they need this kind of mythological idea for the place. But then there are also insiders who are telling a lot of stories about the place too. Yeah, so that just felt true to the way that I could write about it. And I think when I think of this as like a collection of Alaska stories, I think of it as like, oh yeah, it's about like, it's stories about Alaska. Yeah. So hopefully that answered your question, even though it took a little ways. Yeah.
No, that definitely answered my question. But it really made me think of a question that I believe Chris had in mind. He was really interested in lying and how lying works in these stories. Chris?
Yeah, it seemed like sometimes when they ended up lying, they kind of called forward this worry that, like, not every time, but, you know, that they couldn't get it right. Like, it seemed like they were concerned with getting something right or telling a story appropriately. And it's interesting to hear you talk about that, David, like almost like that was something subconscious in you, like wanting to get the story right. And then you have some characters that want to get the story right. And then they end up lying. And sometimes it feels like the lie is not simply a lie. Maybe it's representative of a deeper truth. I guess I'm wondering, I wondered from a couple angles on this. Like, we delve into craft, you know, in these discussions, you know, so what does it feel like when you're writing something, and when you're doing storytelling and the subject of storytelling comes up, I feel like there's a kind of a dance that you do as an artist there, but also like if there's something thematically interesting to you in that, you said that it is something that appears in your writing, mm-hmm. In general. So talk about that.
Yeah, sure. Well, I think the character, I like what you said, the characters kind of often start off trying to tell the truth. They're trying to get some kind of catharsis or some kind of sense out of things by telling these stories. And then they find that part of it is that they find this a challenge in actually getting at the truth and kind of threading out their self-interest from that, because there's often a kind of short-term emotional satisfaction they get from fibbing. So, and then there's also just the kind of, I guess it's a kind of a meta question of like how challenging it is to actually just get the story right. But I think, you know, those kind of questions, I never feel like they are questions. I don't want them to be predominantly intellectual questions in the stuff I write, especially in this book, but in everything else. You know, there are stories that make them intellectual questions that are much more about like the writerly process. And those are really cool stories. But for me, I just feel like they're much more emotional stories that have to do with very specific stakes in the stories that I'm writing. It's lived stories, right? So like the very first story, Nomads, is, you know, one of the things he does is the father in that story falsifies his identity in a lot of ways, right? He falsifies his identity partially as just like a helper and a nice person. But also he falsifies his past, like his ancestry, right? He's one of these people who makes claim to Indian ancestry, but the story never says that it's not true. But in my own mind, it's not true at all. That's just something he seizes on. And to me, that's not I don't want that to be an intellectual question in the story about like how stories are being told. That's a secondary interest of mine. Mostly it has high emotional stakes because he has a daughter who's invested in these stories and invested in the idea of him. And so I want that stuff to have an emotional kick when someone lies, when the reader is asking questions of those kind of questions about stories. They are always hopefully tied to questions of a very specific person in some kind of relationship that matters, rather than thinking broadly, you know, about these kind of meta questions that are, again, also super interesting. And there's all sorts of writers who do that in ways that I find satisfying. That's just not where I live as a writer or like a human being.
Well, I like that you brought up nomads and that particular lie. And I guess you mentioned the stakes of lying with lying to about, you know, his ancestry and that lie, you know, the stakes of that are kind of enforced by the fact that he's, you know, got this daughter. I'm thinking of also of Fair Forward Voyagers and then I'm Here, the title story. In those, we kind of get a glimpse inside of the heads of characters who are lying. I'm Here, I think, is really strikingly at the end is a moment of breaching potentially into this truthful space of like sort of like coming clean to something, and then we kind of gesture in that direction, but we don't go all the way there. So and I'll say, like, I was deeply moved by that. I'm not sure if I understand why, but there's an emotional truth to that that you were getting at. And I don't know, maybe you could talk about that a little bit.
Yeah, you know, that's one where I feel like I'm exploring these, you know, this weird intimacy between two people who are probably, you know, the person on the other end of that internet conversation is probably also lying in some ways. And, you know, it's a black man who's impersonating a white woman on the internet, and it is getting, you know, various levels of satisfaction out of that, but also not getting quite what he needs, right? And, you know, again, that's, you know, on the intellectual level, that's about the limits of in a way, like my own level of knowledge, like the way that we impersonate characters, right? So I want the reader at an intellectual level thinking about, like, how writers accommodate people who are unlike them, right? But so it's kind of about representation and the way, you know, a kind of public conversation about what writers are allowed to do and what people were allowed to inhabit and what we're not, that kind of thing. So it's supposed to be provocative in that way. And then also it's about on a kind of cathartic kind of way, you know, all his experiences with poverty, with this horse that he's grieving for, and so on and so forth as the story unfolds, get kind of placed within this relationship that's mainly just kind of supposedly erotic, and kind of playing around with exploitation and all this kind of stuff. I partly it's about how you can kind of find that kind of solace in very unlikely sources, right? He's looking for it in these other places and not finding it. He's lonely, so on and so forth. But then there's this voice that he is somehow able to make a connection with. So, you know, I think it's a very sad story, but I also think it's supposed to be, in a weird way, kind of uplifting.
I'm sorry to interrupt. I read it aloud to my wife, Mare.
Oh, that's cool.
That story aloud to Mare, yeah. And and we agreed it's sad, but it's not actually very sad. It's a almost sweetly, there's a kind of sweetness to it. And considering like what that is in that story, that's kind of a magic trick. I'm it's sad, but it's not despondent, and it feels, it was actually kind of sweet reading it. I don't know how else to put it.
Yeah, and it's, you know, here's someone who's like, I think this is true to some extent for everybody, but, you know, we perform our own lives a little bit. And so here's a character who's the stages on which he performs are very different than one another, right? So like it started almost as an exercise in saying, like, how can I put this person in these very different places and see who they are in these different contexts, right? So yeah, there's a sense of like these sharp cuts moving back and forth between these different experiences. But out of that came this place of like, he's finding something very real in this relationship, you know, that on the internet, even though he's created this complete falsification, right? And, you know, he's trans, you know, that's part of it too, is like that I think of the main character as flirting with trans issues, but he has no language, right? I don't even know what pronoun to use here because it's he in the story, but he also has this female identity and everything. He's flirting around with these ideas, but because of who he is, he doesn't have any kind of language to attach to that. So I was interested in that too. So there's like a, you know, he's also getting a validation from that in one place, which is this conversation with, you know, this person who really doesn't even know who he is. Yeah.
Speaking of language, we've been using the term lying and falsification a lot. But I wonder, this was something I was really interested in. I wonder if a better term comes from the story Shapeshifters, where the main character asks her clients to refer to her as sir and he, though the narrator refers to her as her, and then specifically the resonance of this idea of shape-shifting with the I'm here story about Edison, the guy taking care of this the ailing horse, but also having this kind of illicit online affair but it's catfishing. But I came away from both of these stories with positive feelings for the main characters, even though you know, specifically in I'm Here, you know, if you just describe what Edison was doing to some objective third party, you'd be like, this person is not a good person. But really, Edison is deeply empathetic. So it feels like shape-shifting may be a better term, if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, catfishing is a bit of a trickster kind of behavior, right? Anyway, right? So yeah, the two are it's funny because I'm Here was an earlier story I wrote for the collection, and Shapeshifters is one of the later ones, but it was very intentional to kind of have them bookending the collection. Mm-hmm. I thought they kind of speak to each other in different ways. But yeah, so I think that's thank you for that. That's a really, I think, nice insight into the way the two talk at each other. Right. And it's definitely like, you know, the narrator, or I should say the protagonist of Shapeshifters, there's, you know, they make that request, and so part of it is this kind of idea that when, you know, a certain kind of performance is reality, right? Like that, why not? That's who they are. That's actually based on a real, you know, a sliver of a real person, that I did some historical research on. It's that person, you know, trying to find a way, you know, into this particular society, this particular Alaskan culture. They have a really important role there. And in a way, it's like a bargain that they're making with people. Like, I will help you as a doctor if you can do this for me. And there's a corroboration there. That story is partially about deals, mm-hmm. right? There's a deal made at the end too. So yeah, I think the two definitely kind of hold hands a little bit. And I don't think either, I don't want either of them to leave you with an entirely, you know, negative feeling, even though that, you know, in one there's a death and so on and so right. forth. Yeah, so shape-shifting is super important. There's other kind of shape-shifting that goes on, too, in the collection.
Did you want to talk about that? Like, what other...
Sure, I can pull out another story if you'd like to kind of... Yeah. So another one that has a kind of magical quality to it would be Marriage or Wolves, right? Where... You know, there's this character who kind of breaches the fabric of reality and walks out into this ice storm and then experiences this kind of, I guess, like a fracture where all these men are frozen and kind of examines this stuff. And I don't, that whole story is a form of, I think, kind of mysticism and a kind of alteration of reality, but I don't want it to be located in just in fantasy. It's supposed to kind of be on this line, right, where you're not sure how to take it. It's not just a fiction created by this woman who's ill or anything like that, and neither is it true, right? So I want it to kind of occupy that same space that, like, the shape-shifting in Shapeshifters occupies, that kind of thing. So yeah, there's other stories where I'm kind of thinking about that kind of at a way where it, where reality is altered in a way that it's not lying. It's like there's a validation to it and there's a truth to it that's very positive and powerful. And the Black Bear Month, right, where this woman is playing basketball, is another one. The way that she's able to kind of transform, and the way the basketball game becomes something that's not just reality. There's all sorts of weird things that are happening in it. So, yeah, so it's something I'm thinking about to greater or lesser extents in a bunch of the stories.
Hans, you had a question specifically about the dreaminess or surrealism of Marriage or Wolves. Did you want
to? Yeah, I mean, well, and it might be that listening to what you said just now, it might be that you would disagree with the premise of the question a little bit, actually. But maybe if you do that, that would be an interesting approach to it. I just, you know, when I was reading Marriage and Wolves, is it Marriage and Wolves or Marriage or Wolves? I don't know.
Marriage or Wolves. Yeah, it's like a
Marriage or Wolves. Yeah. When I was reading
that.
You got
one or the other.
Right. I guess if you have both, that could be really exciting. But
it
at the time that I was reading it, I think it struck me in the moment as kind of being in a different sort of register of reality than the other things in the collection, right? That there's a kind of explicit surrealism to it that felt very different from the other pieces in the collection. It reminded me a little bit, actually, in a workshop that we had years and years ago, we read Platte River by Rick Bass.
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
And in particular, there's a lot of kind of nature winter imagery in that story, and a way that it interweaves kind of the tone and structure of a conventional literary fiction story with these kind of diversions into surrealism that are often, like, not really flagged as such. And it takes a little while to realize, like, oh, this is going somewhere. This is going into a kind of register of dreaminess or oddity or surrealism that's not what I would have expected. And I think that, like, the question I was going to ask originally was how you thought about integrating that shift and how you thought about kind of easing the reader into the understanding that, you know, this is not something that happens in the same kind of conventional realist mode that most of the rest of the collection is. But it sounds like actually maybe that's a misunderstanding on my part, and you really kind of thought of that piece as being, like, your sense was that there were actually other things in the collection that had some of the same qualities, and maybe it's more intense or more overt in that story, but it's actually not qualitatively different from what the other stories are doing in their relationship to reality.
I mean, I do think, I think it's a good question. I think I was consciously trying to be a little more surreal and not worry about making sense during the writing process of that story. So like the starting place of it especially was completely in line with like where your question is coming from. It just like this sense of like, oh, often in, when I'm writing very realistically, there's a kind of determinism that I'm following in terms of like things just being factually real and certain like certain cohesions, I guess I'm looking to like, you know, that stories kind of can, yeah, just certain kind of logic and everything in terms of how the stories are coming together. And I just didn't want to worry about that quite as much in that story. But I also think it's a question of scale, because I felt like some of the things that I was trying to do in that story were also happening in a much smaller level in at least two or three other stories in the collection. It's just that, like, I think there's a kind of magic fever dream quality to Marriage or Wolves, fairy tales, you know, little Karen Russell in there maybe. And that's mediated through technology, and I'm here. And so that feels like they do kind of fit together. And, you know, something like Shapeshifters fits into that. And then even though it happens on a basketball court, you know, all those, so there's this kind of realistic setting, all that stuff that's getting thrown on the court, right? It starts following a dream logic. Like there are things being thrown on that basketball court by the crowd that just can't, you know, be thrown on there. And it's not, she's not just making that up. That's also kind of fractured reality in a way. So yeah, so there's things like that where I think, oh, like this is something that actually does, it's just how I'm proportioning it in different stories, how I'm like bringing the levels up, raising the volume on that element of the story. So, but it was, you know, I think it's important to recognize that it does kind of stand out in a way from the other stories. It was something that I was consciously trying to do, is like, just how far can I push my own comfort level in a way, like my own habits about like what I write about and how I write about it. So, yeah.
I think that there's an effect too, where the setting, I mean, the connection to Alaska in a way maybe cracks the door open for a little bit more of those kinds of quiet distortions of reality.
Sure.
I'm, you know, like thinking about the objects being thrown on the basketball court, like I've never been to a basketball game in rural Alaska, right? Like maybe they throw crazy shit on the basketball court.
Right.
Who knows,
right,
you know?
Right.
And I mean, that's to some extent kind of a dumb, ignorant thing to say, but it's still kind of a response that I had when I was reading it. Like the way that we're kind of the vaguely kind of otherworldly sense that a lot of people have of Alaska, I think makes it easier to slip a little bit of that uncanniness in, right? There, in Marriage or Wolves, there's, before she goes into the bar that's totally frozen, there she like finds birds that have been frozen in mid-flight and fallen out of the sky. And
right,
I mean, I lived in Fairbanks for 4 years, and if somebody told me, oh, that's a thing that happens, I probably would have believed them, right? I had to think for a second, like, did I hear about that? Is that actually like a phenomenon in like sudden winter storms in interior Alaska? And I think that it kind of gives you leverage to play with that a little bit in a way that, you know, if it were like Minnesota stories, maybe you wouldn't have.
Yeah. So there's that, right? Is like just the level of our own knowledge about a place either that we've heard about or even lived for a while, like in your case, right? Because I agree with you. Like, you know, I lived there in total, you know, maybe twice as long as you did. But I still had those kind of questions about, you know, what really would that happen? And then also like, what is my investment in this being real? Right. So like, why am I inclined to believe this? Like, do I want to believe these things? I think that's kind of an interesting kind of question about like when you're thinking about a place you live or a place that you want to travel to or something like that, is like, where is your investment in the fantasy coming from? Because like, there's something really cool about this idea that, you know, a bird could be frozen in the air and falling down, and what, you know, about like what it means to be, live in a place like that, and like your self-determinism in a place like that, and like, how tough you are to live in a place where birds freeze in mid-flight.
And Alaskans are very invested, in my experience at least. I mean, having lived in Fairbanks for 4 years, like, a lot of the people who live there are very invested in that myth of toughness, right? Like,
yeah, the mythology is.
When
is,
you move like, there, a lot of people want to tell you how hard it is to be there. And, I mean, it seemed to me like there was a certain amount of mythologizing in that, right?
Yeah, I completely agree, right? It's like, when you think about Fairbanks, right, it is a hard place to live. I don't want to take that away from anybody because it very much is, especially for some people, right? That's another part of it, right?
Right, like, right. I think a lot of people kind of increase the challenge deliberately, right? They make it harder than it has to be. But
yeah, because it's a way, you know, you seize that as an identity pretty quickly when you live there, even if, you know, in my case, you're a college professor. Right, who's living in, you know,
right,
and essentially what we used to call the wilderburbs, right? Where it's just like, yeah, you know, we have a well and we have this kind of thing, but we also have, you know, running water and two bathrooms in our house, you know, that kind of thing. So it's very easy to kind of slide into that as a way of seeing yourself, that I live in this place where it's so hard, and that means that I'm strong and I have a lot of like free will and I, you know, all this kind of stuff that probably needs some examination. Yeah. You know, I think that also like there's, you know, the women in the story, in these stories are often encountering that stuff. So it's like, obviously it's no accident that this woman goes out walking in the snowstorm in Marriage or Wolves and then encounters all these first frozen birds and then frozen men. Right, in this bar where she often feels alienated, right? There's these,
right,
sometimes these encounters with these kind of mythologies are also encounters with men. So
this,
it makes me think a little bit about the, oh sorry, were you
no
gonna
no no
else?
Go ahead, Hans. I was thinking of shifting to something related but a little tangential, so keep going.
Well, and this is one of the, this I was going to connect that to one of the questions I had sent, which had to do with the story Make Me Whole, right? Because I think that's very much a story about mythologizing. And I found it structurally very interesting because, you know, you start with this, with what I guess we're supposed to understand as kind of the original version of this experience, right? Like you start with this raw, unmediated experience or unprocessed experience of watching somebody cut their own wedding ring out of a fish. And then over the course of the story, that original event gets retold and mutated and retold and mutated and kind of almost kind of passed on in a way, like an inheritance from the mother to the mother character to the protagonist. And thematically, I think that's interesting because it has to do with some of the mythologizing that we were talking about, right? And the way that people who live in Alaska for some period of time have an urge or an instinct to mythologize it. And at the same time, though, I think from a craft standpoint, it's very interesting because, I mean, as a reader, like, I rarely double back in stories, right? Like, I don't usually reread early things. But with that one, by the end of the story, I had to go back to the beginning and really had to go back to the beginning and kind of remind myself how it started, right? Because the distortions and the mutations that happen to it as the two characters retell it are kind of persuasive enough that they eventually, even in a relatively short story, like they ended up kind of displacing the original in my mind as
right,
a reader.
Right.
And I think, like, I don't know if you wanted to talk about the thematics of that or the craft of that. I mean, I think thematically it's interesting, in terms of mythologizing and representation of self and all the kind of story related things we've been talking about. It's maybe one of the less uplifting versions of that.
Yeah.
But then at the same time, from a craft standpoint, it's just very interesting. Like, I was very curious if the kind of that central device of the mutation of that anecdote, if that was something that had been core to how you thought about that story when you began it, or if it was something you discovered organically as it developed.
You know, it's funny. There's a couple stories in here that start with the kind of kernel of them started with actually real stories. So that story of the fish is something that is the entirety of this story is so much made up stuff. But that little kernel of the anecdote is actually kind of a real thing that I exaggerated slightly for telling in the story. So the impetus for it was just this remembrance, which might be interesting to people, but because it is someone
who, it does have, like, a meta quality to it, I guess, right? Like, you began by exaggerating that anecdote.
So it even the starting the same place process
that the characters do.
And the thing is that, like, I don't quite know, you know, it's like, it's just something my father and I experienced, and my father is dead, so I can't have that conversation with him. So it's just something that I know I've falsified, but I'm not quite sure how. But is like this, that, you know, a fish eats a finger, then the people eat the fish. And so, so that was the kind of kernel of that. But I one of the things that I found in that story was like the tenacity. I was interested in that story and like the tenacity of someone pursuing this anecdote and changing it. But that tenacity actually just becomes a kind of loop, right? It's like a dog pulling at a chain, but it's almost like paralytic. Like when the dog pulls on the chain, the chain pulls taut and they can't move, right? So even though there's a lot of motion in that story, like the characters are driving around a lot, they're traveling, they're moving to all these different locations, they're also kind of standing still. I think it's one of the more pessimistic stories in the collection. And so, yeah, like I think about like the way that the two main characters in that story are kind of seizing on these stories as a way to kind of make sense of themselves. But really, for whatever reason, all it does is kind of become this stasis, right? I picture them even making more permutations of that story, you know, as it continues, but it's not really getting them anywhere. And I think people do that, right? I think occasionally I've done that, where you just, there's this kind of constant retelling that's not getting you anywhere. So it just, that just felt, when I finished that story, it just felt like, oh, this is like a slightly different slant on some of the other things I'm writing about. There were a few Alaska stories that didn't make it into the collection because I didn't feel like they really dovetailed with the ideas as much. But that one felt like, oh yeah, this one belongs in the book. I'll kind of put it with the others. Did that answer your question?
Yes. It's interesting, actually, like the way that the, you know, you mentioned the story kind of, the mutations to that story having a circular quality or having a quality of not getting them any further. It almost becomes kind of a sign of increasing desperation, right? Like the further that get from the core, the more that they try to own it, the further they actually feel from some sense of kind of meaning and stability and connection. It's like the more degraded that it becomes, the more we get a sense of kind of the collapse of their own movement toward whatever kind of personal goals or fulfillment they'd hoped for. And degraded is maybe not the right word for it, right? It's like it's like if you took the same image and ran it through a copier over and over, and it somehow got more spectacular instead of breaking down.
Totally, yeah. Which goes back to, you know, again, it's like these themes that I'm obsessed with, right? So like the fact that it's funny that you mentioned that, because like, you know, my first book is all about copies of copies of copies, right? So it's funny, like this is a lesson in like how you can't escape your own little obsessions, right? I don't know. It's like I can't write stories about things that aren't that. In some ways, I think I would like to, but maybe Make Me Whole is a little bit about my own obsessions, like how I find this theme and I keep digging and digging and digging at it, and like a little bit worry about how that repetition is actually getting me somewhere, or am I just doing different versions of the same thing? Because we're back at my first book, right? And just like copy centers, and but I do think I don't think it's one of my favorite stories in the book, but it adds something, you know, it kind of rounds it out in a way that I think is kind of interesting.
So, shifting gears a little bit, You know, I don't have a smooth segue or anything to this topic I've been thinking of, but this is a question that we have talked about on the podcast in the past in other context, but it's actually very personal for me. For the last 6 years or so, I've been working on a novel with a character, a main character, who is a Bengali woman who is a former Muslim. And, you know, now she is an apostate, so to speak. And the reason I bring this up is because it seems like in this collection, specifically the story The Black Bear Month, and maybe another one, the protagonist is someone who is not you, basically. And I mean someone who is not, who is as demographically different from you as we can think of. And I was wondering how you approach writing from an extremely different perspective, especially in this day and age where there are calls to, you know, people shouldn't be writing stories that aren't theirs to tell, if you understand what I'm saying. So,
sure. Like the... Yeah, which is an important thing to consider. I think. Yeah. I think about this a lot, actually, you know, partially too because I'm a teacher and I want to give, you know, the complexity of that. And also just because I'm a white person, right? So it's important for me to think about those kind of things and seizing on, you know, something that isn't mine and somehow, you know, forwarding my career about that. So in each of the stories where there's feels like I move out of my own, you know, my own self a little bit, there has been an interrogation that I've done about why I'm doing that. And then also, I think this is really important. I think there's an interrogation in the story about that, about what it means to do that. So like, I'm here is about that. Right. And, you know, one of the things, my point of pride for me in that is that, you know, that story was published in a magazine whose head editor is African American, and he wrote me specifically and told me that he was interested in that idea of representation, and the story was not just someone seizing that identity without reflection. Right. It was about that idea, and it was interesting to read because of that. Okay, so I think that's part of it. You know, I think there's things to, there's some really, there's an essay called The Racial Imaginary, which is actually like all your listeners would, I think, really benefit from this. Writing in the Racial Imaginary, and I'm trying to think of the writer again, but it's a really interesting about, like, it's written by a Black woman who's talking about when this might be appropriate, and when, I think, like, this issue of rights, like when people, you know, when a white male writer says, like, I have the right to do this, I don't think that's in dispute. Like, the whole cultural conversation about rights is really, it's kind of silly, because I don't think anyone is really debating whether you're, like, you can do it.
Sure.
Like, but I think what, especially like a lot of people of color are asking is, I think, maybe I'm wrong here, but is like, really ask why you are doing it. And then also like if you're going to write about these things, right, do you have to, I think some people, I have had conversations with people of color about this, is like, where the only time, say, that people, I'm seizing on race because it's maybe the most provocative part of this, but there's all sorts of, but like, when, you know, people, white writers write about race, they always go to a person of a different race, but they don't write about their own white behavior, right? They don't examine that. So like when they're writing about a white character, that is not a theme.
Right. And yeah.
And someone told me that, and that felt like, oh yes, you are right. Like that is very much a thing that is happening, that has been done historically and that kind of thing. And I should really think about that. So like in the story, The Black Bear Month, that is in a way, that's a love letter to a dear friend of mine who I interviewed for the story, who I showed the story to when I was done and said, like, you have veto power on this. If you want me to put this in a drawer and just forget about it, you can do that. So there was like a process that I feel like I followed in that right. story that made sense to me. So, you could probably have a whole podcast
just about that. Well, yeah,
multiple
yeah.
podcasts just about this. Yeah. And then there's another thing that I think is really interesting about this that I've been thinking about lately is like, what are the areas, right? When we talk about like writing about outside oneself, right? And we think about the conversations about when you're not allowed to do this and when you are, what areas of identity are omitted from that conversation, right? And this to me feels like a very 2023, 2024, 2025 kind of conversation to have, right? Which is, are there areas of identity that are ignored when we talk about representation? As a person who comes from poverty, right? I think it's very interesting that we have not had a cultural conversation criticizing people who might write outside their class. Mm. And why is that? And it's not just because class is permeable, because class, it's not just because we move from class to class, because most people don't right. in this society, right? Most people stay in the class in which they are born. So I think there's further nuance that has to happen there in terms of these conversations, right? About what's allowed and what's sure. not. I think, and I'm not saying that, what I'm saying is like, you can't write about someone in a different class. What I'm saying is like, the conversation needs to be even more complicated about it and talk about why is there a kind of reflexive attitude that was invisible?
Right.
Right. Because to me, that seems as important as any other kind of level of identity. That is as formative, right? You ask a Marxist,
sure.
right? What are the core, you know, core signifiers of identity? And that's going to be it. And so we can't invalidate that either. So I don't know. Maybe I've given you a very long-winded kind of quasi-academic.
I thought it was awesome. Our I think my response when this has been brought up before on the podcast, my thought was, you can do it. You just have to make sure that you do it well and with empathy, really. But I like your answer because it's deeper. It's more nuanced than that. Not that my answer is like totally a whiff or anything, but.
No, I think yours is a good one too. And it's like, some of it is like, what is right. empathy? And part of empathy, right. part of empathy is examining the limits of your own imagination. Right. right? So like right. When you're writing, like, are you doing that? You know, cause you're not, I mean, again, it's like the conversations about like the knowledge about someone else. I think it's a given that we don't know about other people with very different right. experiences than us. And I think it's a given that all experience isn't universal, right? Like there's no way to you think of the best books you've ever read. And I don't think you can argue that they're truly universal, right? Or that we can know other, like that there's this kind of magic way that this, you know, a certain novel encompasses all these different experiences. It's the writer's subjective take right. on that.
Sure.
But I think that's kind of cool in a way. That's like part of fiction.
Absolutely. Yeah. A writer's specific take on a specific character is definitely, you know, something that draws you in.
Yeah. So, Yeah, I just think also, you know, this is the part of it that I'm hopeful about, is I actually just feel like there are more interesting conversations to come on that subject. Like, it feels like we're actually, I think they're happening right now, but I think, like, say 2018 or so, the conversations around it were like stepping stones to get to a place that was even more complicated. And yeah, so yeah, I think it'll be interesting to see where we are in 5 years in talking about this kind of stuff.
Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. It does no help to the conversation when people take these stances, you know, often by like white traditional writers that are just like adamant, like, and they do this kind of like a few years ago, there's that, well, whatever, I won't even get into it. It's not worth even giving them like audio time on this, but like people who are just willful about it. So I can do whatever I want and da, 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 you know, you can't stop me, like that right. kind of thing where they evoke censorship.
Right.
Just feels like, yeah, it that feels just so strident that it doesn't help with the conversation. Anyway.
Okay. This has been great, David. We have kind of reached the end of the questions that we had. Unless you want to discuss your take on Nietzsche or Marx, you know, we're
I was going to say, Patrick, David really gave you an opening there. That was with the Marxism.
Well, I did want to say, David, that one of my favorite parts of the book was that was one of the stories, a woman who had been to South America mentions that at least when the men in South America stare at your tits, they're talking about Marx. So I thought that was pretty hilarious.
Yeah, and it's kind of true. Yeah, there's a lot of sexism there, but also there like the kind of political yeah. culture is yeah. so different. Yeah, yeah.
So Hans or Chris, do you have anything else you want to ask David before we sign off?
I feel sated.
Okay.
I think.
Okay. Excellent.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah.
All right.
And just let me say again, you know, it's so good to talk to the three of you. It brings back lots of good memories, and it's really great that you guys are doing this. It's
yeah,
exciting.
I have really enjoyed being on the podcast. I assume Hans and Chris have as well, and I'm super excited that you agreed to join us. As I told you, we had Daryl Farmer on once a while ago. So I take any opportunity I can to get back in touch with, you know, writers that I've worked with and who have helped me become a better writer. So I'm just really thankful that you agreed to be here. Okay, listeners, this has been our discussion with David Nicky Krause of their book I'm Here, Alaska Stories. We are going to come back next week as usual, though it's still up in the air what we're going to talk about next time. So just stay tuned, and you'll know what we're going to get into pretty soon.